Okay.
Good evening. Welcome. Thank you for coming. The 30th anniversary season of River Styx at Dusk. Tonight we have two very interesting and diverse writers. Rockwell Gray will be reading some nonfiction, and Deborah Kang Dean will be reading some poetry. We're going to start with the poetry tonight. Some poems are songs, some elegies, others seductions and prayers. Deborah Kang Dean's poems are largely meditations, but they're meditations rooted deeply in the world and the world of things. Almost no poet I can think of more naturally subscribes to William Carlos Williams' doctrine, no ideas but in things. Deborah Kang Dean thinks in images and things, both metaphorically and with a literal Zen-like direct pointing, as in her three-part seasonal diary, Patchwork of Selvage, from her newest book, Precipitates, a series which begins, snow, a few red pines edging the lawn outside this window's 40 panes. In a white world, they harbor islands still green where they stand between Earth's blank slate and the slate gray sky. Aging is like this, whittled down by gusts, fallen away, all dead wood. What's left bends, then rights itself, even under the burden of snow, winter's argument. Like Robert Frost, Dean's argument is a lover's quarrel with the world, less detached than the care and craft and closely observed detail might suggest. That ambivalence comprises the core of so much of her work, as in the poem Strays, where Dean writes of her son leaving home and also leaving her two cats, Basho and Cricket. What prescient wisdom led him to leave me these cats, to tether me to a world I might too easily forsake, to practice daily tenderness? As Alison Hawthorne Deming remarks, Deborah Kang Dean writes with disarming clarity and a formal beauty at once experimental and highly structured. Along with a highly structured free verse, she writes sonnets and haiku. The Patchwork of Selvage series, for example, experiments with rinku, alternating three-line haikus with seven-syllabled couplets. Her newer work weaves similar patchworks with more obsessive forms, such as Sistina's. We just did Sistina's class, right? No? And Pontoum's. But we still hear her obsessive, unflinching eye for detail, for things, the things around her and her meditations on the world and her ongoing argument with the world. Born in Honolulu, Hawaii, Deborah Kang Dean is a third-generation American of Korean and Okinawan ancestry. After graduating from high school, she spent one semester at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, then enlisted in the Air Force. She received both a BA and an MA from Eastern Washington University on the GI Bill, and in 1989 received an MFA from the University of Montana. Her books include News of Home, which co-won the Sheila Margaret Motten Award, and Precipitates, both from BOA Editions. Her poems have appeared in Best American Poetry, The New American Poets, a Breadloaf Anthology, Yobo, Korean American Writing in Hawaii, and many periodicals, including Crab Orchard Review, Plowshares, and Southern Review. She teaches in the Spalding Brief Residency MFA program, where she is a hell of a workshop leader, and currently lives in Peterborough, New Hampshire, with her husband, Brad, and Basho and Cricket, the aforementioned two cats. Please welcome Deborah Kang Dean.
Practicing what I learned at Spalding, adjust the microphone patiently. Thank you all for coming out. I'm going to be reading some new work and also some work from both of my books. I'm going to begin with a November poem that's called Hail. I was 11 the first time I saw it, the November afternoon gone heavy and gray. I'd begun to doze when something, not palm fronds rustling, nor monkey pods rattling, but more like spoons against glass or small bells, something began clinking against the second stories, blue paling and rails, lightly at first, bringing all of us, even the teacher, to our feet and not the door. Not since, 3 years before, when the staticky Standard Oil broadcast had been interrupted by news that brought to tears even Miss Engard, who didn't tax our imaginations too hard, playing the part of witch at Halloween, had there been so much commotion. Seeing our teachers openly weeping had frightened us even more than a word like assassination. Above us, concrete, under our feet, concrete, and all of us stretching our hands beyond the blue rails to catch as they fell clear pieces of sky that burned a second, melting in our hands. When I lived in Massachusetts, I got an education in snow. I spent a lot of time shoveling snow because I was practicing Tai Chi outdoors, and this is one of my snow poems. It's called Weather Report. 15 miles west of Boston, and mostly the news is of small creatures and snow. A self-appointed snow inspector, I tune in to the weather. Snow and sun, sometimes cloud or showers or wind or chattery letters that spell chilly. As with everywhere I've lived, the forecasters look like Vanna White surrogates or used car salesmen. Still, they grow on you like poker pals upping the ante with shifts of pressure. Sometimes the weather calls their bluff. Still, they at least seem to know where they are. Right now, a light snow is falling, a steady downpour of flakes fine as gnats. To her usual what's up, I give my old friend the usual answer. Same old shit shoveled the different way. I bundle up. Before I thread my fingers through the shovel's handle, it flashes a conspiratorial grin. As I mentioned, I spent a lot of time shoveling out an area to practice Tai Chi. While I lived in Massachusetts, I practiced on a tennis court, and this next poem begins, at least, with this whole act of shoveling snow. Actually, I'm, at this point, dealing with leaves. It's in the fall, and it's called Readings. It has an epigraph from a poet named Laurent Boisselard, and the epigraph reads, "My lubberly body." That's L-U-B-B-E-R-L-Y. Today's hard sweeping of leaves plastered on asphalt, it's your fault. Yesterday's Tai Chi practice without first sweeping dry leaves, your fault. Out of the woods early last evening, I rode into the city, my hours these days like those tiles framed in a square where the one empty space allows the circuitous maneuvering one must do to make a picture. So I'm here to tell you about my Chinese philosophy professor, whose name escapes me, though his face is clear. Horn-rimmed glasses, a little beak of a nose. 2 weeks into the class, he dragged us through some secondary text on Confucius, word by tedious word. Our eyes glazed. But he kept on, the whole hour stuck on one small paragraph, pausing at every noun and verb as if each were a diamond he couldn't help but turn in the light. Stopping at one point, unable to contain his excitement, he shouted, "I want to drive you home." Well, he got my attention then, and forever, the moon, not the finger pointing. It's amazing how many ways one will maneuver a tool to keep from stooping. Indoors, the vacuum passing 30 ways from Sunday over a single square of carpet to hook a stubborn piece of thread. It's not rational, which calls to mind, since I'm on the subject, another story about him. His 3-year-old asked to give back my 4-year-old's toy car, throwing a tantrum that needed no translation. My teacher shaking his head, smiling and saying, "Excuse him, he's not rational." Neither was I guess, with the stuck leaves and my push broom, each stroke further flattening the leaves, except approached from the leaf stalk. Of course, I did stoop, fondly, to pick one up. What had been simply brown leaves began to distinguish themselves, shagbark hickory, three kinds of oak, American basswood, Norway maple, and even Asiatic bittersweet. These leaves, not the damp sweetness of red and orange and still yellowing leaves you'd stroked, loving their fullness, knowing them poor to breathing poor, but rain-soaked and brown. It's your fault, too, this stopping to note the day's variegated shapes and veiny textures, this momentary stay. Hello, goodbye, both of us already leaving the Bay State. How else to explain this meke aloha? Come to the city for remembrances. I heard once more a companionable voice in exile, moved and moving, wanting to drive you home. Ave no salve atque vale. Is that how you say it? Think of me squaring the circle outdoors, practicing wordless the art that makes us beautiful. And this is another Taiji poem. It's called The Garment It Wore. As if in stillness silence mattered and would speak, I pressed my lips, my eyelids shut. First a squirrel, like a merchant hawking his wares behind me, while below the squirrel a thrasher scratched in the brush. The far-off knock of a woodpecker echoed here above me in one nut hatch. The wind set the pines humming. One brown leaf lifted, then grazed the asphalt. When I opened my eyes, on the ground near my right foot, one dead bee. So still it was, so precise, the brown and yellow stripes on the garment it wore. 3 weeks till the equinox. Winter-long deer stitched their beeline through this place I've shoveled off for practice, entering unseen across the cleared space and leaving, then vanishing into the woods, daily their tracks blurring in the crusted over snow. By then, I'd forgotten the question all day I'd borne with me. By then, I'd remembered the riddle my own name made. Given, not chosen, then chosen, and chosen again when the late light touched me, when you called me in. This next poem is called Taproot, and it's a poem about my father, but I really think it's my own Ars Poetica poem. My father's a perfectionist, and I'm my father's daughter, I think. Stooping to pull up a weed, I think of my father, who made of weeding an art. After work, he'd take a bucket and his weeder from the tool shed and clear an area of a yard he knew would never look manicured, whose quality would, at best, be like something homemade. He'd set the bucket upside down and sit on it. Plotting a route, he'd shift the bucket, a move so deft you might think he was just leaning out to extend his reach. He knew exactly where and what angle to drive the weeder down north and south of the weed without severing its taproot. When my father worked like this, making small mounds he'd later gather up in his bucket, the dog would sniff at his bare feet, then lie down in the shade his body made. Grounded there, he was most himself, his hunger for perfection and control giving way finally to the work itself. It was easy to love him then. I now live in West Peterborough, New Hampshire, which is very near the McDowell Colony. There's a lake there that's also called the reservoir. It was created when a river there was dammed, the river that flooded the center of Peterborough in 1938. And during my first year there, used to go up there to practice Tai Chi, which involved shoveling off a pavilion up there. And this poem is set in that area in February 2003. And this is called Beyond McDowell Lake. On the pavilion surrounded by snow, a spider magnified by sunlight crawls. Its shadow wheels then jerks along like a tank. What brings on the season of ease struggles all over to be born. A few men on their ATVs thunder across the lake in Bactus, appearing through the woods, after laying down in a figure eight, a track for the occasional visitor walking a dog, the recreational snowshoer. From the pavilion, the man-made lake, and beyond it, the mountain, dwarf even the ATVs. But, of course, when I descend, the acrid smell of gasoline hangs in the air above the wide path leading up to the parking lot. One of the wonderful things about being invited to join the faculty at Spalding was I was able to connect with one of my teachers from the University of Montana, Greg Pape. And as a consequence of being in this environment together, we decided we would collaborate on a poem. And I want to read you what we have so far. It's eight sections. We're each working loosely with the form of the ghazal, which is a Persian form. And I'm just going to read through them. The tentative title of this is Parallel Parking. All through that summer, she lingered, dreaming of rain, tracing the rim of a chilled glass beaded with rain. The wind picked up, lifting and crumpling newspaper skirts and dead leaves annealed by the rain. The gray sky thickened as Cain walked away. Blood darkened the soil in the field like rain. You called on the waiter to bring wine for the house, mercifully blurry, the world seen through rain. No more, said Lipo, longing for home, and no more, as under a waxing moon cool rain fell. Under a waxing moon, cool rain fell for hours. An owl dozed, ducks preened, the heron lurched low for hours. Nothing could account for the way she moved. He stared at the window streaked with rain, remembering for hours. The map torn, the route uncertain, tire flat, bottle empty. They laughed, it seemed, for hours. I don't care for flags, he said, or limousines, funeral homes, headstones, sick of the news. He didn't care for hours. A monk sat still as moonlight on the frozen lake, emptying his mind, counting his breath for hours. Counting his breath for hours until the last one seized his racked body, the very last one. After the sun set, with each desolate house they passed, she thought, what if this light were the last one? Red Rover, they chanted over and over. He sized up the weak link, then charged the last one. In Haifa, one more explosion, one more in Kirkuk. Hard to believe it will be the last one. Last night, Ramon, the old dream of drowning, on my lips the taste of salt when I woke, released at last. When I woke, released from a dream, a bird, a robin flew through itself at a reflected image of a bird. In the east window, the sun rose, and the dream faded into a bird, a confused bird defending its territory from itself, an image in the glass of a bird, a red-breasted bird moving to meet the challenge of the intruder, the glass bird, a bird, only in a bird's mind, until I closed my eyes and drifted back to sleep and dreamed myself a bird. Again, drifting out of the dream of birds, she opened the window. In drifted the sound of birds. She opened the court, the curt verdict the old man passed on unstuck doors and intractable jar lids, gutted deer. It felt like the plane lurched, then fell vertically. Once touched down, we hurried through the door she opened. Just like that, he said, pulling his coat down from over his head. The clear sky clouded, let pour. She opened. Arms length or close up, words strung on the page like birds on a wire. She opened then closed another book. She opened then closed another book of days. Time for a fresh start. Time to step out into lush green days. One day it rains. One day it burns. One day it burns and rains. That's the way with days. Keats said, the poetry of nature is never dead. Crickets, grasshoppers, winds and waters give voice to the days. Master Unmon, when asked, what is your practice? Answered, toilet paper, leaving nothing out in the continuum of days. Walking carefully across the swinging bridge above the Cane River, I feel the rush of days come back. The rush of river of days, days come back, said the aging actor making his brazen comeback. On takeoffs, through tunnels, on roller coaster rides, you held then felt the gush of breath, all praise, I'm back. Why grieve what never was? Still the heart persists in its crazy tug of war, unfazed, come back, come back. That's why they're called bumpers, I keep insisting, ready to parallel park. But he steps out, waves me back. Chasing a leaf, chasing his tail, old spot unleashed runs riot. Come back, his master calls, breathless. Come back, his master calls, breathless to the dog. The wind blows his voice away, and away goes the dog. I have tried in dreams to find you, conjured your touch, your scent, wandering like a lost dog. They carried away what they could as the waters rose, no room in the truck for the dog. Bogalusa to Baghdad, Juarez to Jerusalem, who feeds the nameless dog? God is great, God is small, open the envelope, pet the dog. Next poem is the first attempt I made at this form, the ghazal, and it's you wouldn't recognize it as such because it's written in three-line stanzas instead of two, and it's called Ordinary Moons, and I was trying to put a moon or hide a moon in each of the stanzas, so maybe you'll see them. At bedtime, the child says, "Father, tell me a story." The father calls on Q-tips, a bar of soap, spiders, waters gurgling, and so on. In the living room, the wife draws a light bulb out of the heel of a sock, then with her darning needle weaves to lock the thread. She takes a shirt from her basket to sew on a button. "Do me a favor," she says, as the husband enters the room. "Hand me the blue thread." In their bed, they hug, kiss, and so on. "How like the eye of a needle you sometimes are," she says. "And he, you defy fingering. You are a panpipe or Jupiter's moons, or maybe," and so on. Tomorrow's full moon is the numbered button God lights with his finger, a sign the almanac tells them to sew on. In a month, the seeds will have sprouted. They'll work in the garden, bearing fish heads, weeding, thinning, mulching, and so on. A story, Twain said, is one damn thing after another. But life is only one thing. In full sun, a writer pairs like nails or apple skin, and so on. As Richard mentioned, I was in the Air Force. When you grow up on an island, it's sort of hard to conceive of leaving when all you see is water. So at 18, the only thing I wanted to do was get away from home. So I did the foolish thing of enlisting. And this is a poem that I wrote based on one of my experiences in the Air Force, and it's called Becoming One of the Guys. I was, my unit was, I was in a tactical, I think it's called Tactical Air Support Squadron. We were Army support, and we were deployed to Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico to simulate a war. And my job was in radio repair. So basically what we did was stay up and keep the radios operating and just call, make these calls. And I was at the time the only woman in my group. Becoming one of the guys. When he said my thigh was nothing like his girlfriend's, there was a world of innocence in it. I'd been sitting on the workbench, self-absorbed, bumping the heels of my combat boots against the cabinets when he tumbled in, half drunk, and struggled to close the latch. Next thing I knew, he'd taken my hand, laid his head on my lap, and stretched out beside me. That was when he said it. It startled the rest of the guys on shift, who till then imagined me a sort of holy virgin beyond touch. His one act made me human. And later, before we left Holloman, those Texans risked sneaking me into their hut to celebrate our return to Bergstrom with beers, chips, and several hands of hearts. But that night, where else had he to go? Alcohol could not relieve his sense of separateness, nor make the ghost he was then less real. And there on deployment, we all felt homeless at night in some desert in New Mexico. Though he seemed out of place in his civvies, jeans, plaid shirt, and cowboy boots, how could we tell him he shouldn't be with us? We sat and waited, my arm rising and falling with his steady breathing, so like the waters I turned away from 2 years before in leaving the islands. Until Rick stood, shook him, and whispered, "Dave, wake up. You best head on back to the hut." And this next poem is a poem that's dedicated to Luke Wisnett, who graduated from Washington University. I don't know when. I met him in North Carolina at East Carolina University, where he was the associate and still is the associate editor of a magazine called Tar River Poetry, which I was affiliated with. When I left in 1998, he had been working on a novel called, I think, tentatively titled The Red Guitar. So this is called The Man with the Red Guitar. The man with the red guitar lives a double life. By day, the scarf he wears maps the landscape, a desert, an inlay of thick brown roads, and barely perceptible, the red lines of his intent. Backlit, a moving silhouette, he enters the corridor. There, only the memory of the red guitar slung over his shoulder keeps him upright. In the light of an open door, he becomes himself. It's the shock of artificial green he hates, four windowless walls and the low white ceiling. He pulls a book from a wall of books and in it concedes his heart. Some nights after work, he lets the red guitar repose against him like a close friend whose elbow rests on the sofa's arm, waist curved around him. He asks nothing more than that it be there. After work some nights, he imagines the red guitar's darkly silent mouth as his own and won't even look at it. The red guitar pools like a shadow at his feet. Some nights he pulls the red guitar from the trunk of his car, reclines the passenger's seat, straps in the red guitar, and opens the windows. Light comes through the moonroof. The fine hairs on his arms lift. He hums with the red guitar when the wind brushes its strings. Everything comes into focus. The sky's orange and blue gradations, the crisp line of mountains, the eyes of animals winking out of the dark, the line marking the shoulder he'll follow all night. And I'm going to finish with the poem that's the title poem of my first collection. And it's called News of Home. And what you'll hear is a little bit of what was my first language, Pidgin English. It has an epigraph that's a Japanese proverb. One must go around for news of home. And this is called In the Way Back. In the way back is the part of the station wagon all the way in the back. The Friday before Labor Day, after a day's hard work, my father'd come home, read the paper, then tell my mother, "Mo better take the kids around the island." Next morning, up early, mother'd be telling us to turn off the TV and packing a picnic lunch. Musubi, scrambled eggs, spam, a thermos of watered down exchange. Stuck in the way back of the Valiant, I faced the closed rear window, already hot, thinking how much I hated this. At my back, my grandma sat. Next to her, my brother and sisters dozed. In front of them, my parents sat. In front of them, the long way back. My mother drove. Beside her on the seat, the lunch she packed. My father hung an elbow out the window. Out of the city and into the scenery that blurred ocean sand and trees, I pulled out my pack of cards and played solitaire. My shuffling woke my sister. She reached past the back of the front seat to turn on the radio. Back in her seat, she reached behind and tapped me on the shoulder. She leaned and whispered, "Having one good time already." She laughed and climbed into the way back. And then we were four kids laughing and singing in the way back with the Rascals, "How Can I Be Sure?" and Bill Withers' "Lean on Me." While in between, my grandma sang the chorus, "Mate, mate, you damn kids, look the view," which sounded to us kids like "Rook the few." And in between the singing and the laughing, one of us kept asking, "We stay there, what?" All the way to Haula Beach, where Grandma smoked a cigarette and gathered stones along the shore. The rest of us ate silently, and silently when we were done, we piled into the car. My father drove, slowing or stopping now and again to show us the crouching lion, Chinaman's hat, the blowhole, cocoa head, diamond head, then Honolulu after dark, as if he meant to tell us, when you let the island in you, the road both does and doesn't lead you back. Four kids in the way back of the Valiant, leaning one upon the other. We didn't have to watch the road. Our parents left us free to look in both directions, behind us and ahead. Thank you.